All summer long and into the fall, support for Prop 37 was overwhelming. As recently as September 27th, polls found public support at 66.9%, but as of last week, those numbers had fallen to just 41.9%, putting the ballot measure on the losing side of things for the first time this year. The Yes on Prop 37 campaign has faced withering opposition from big agribusiness, which has spent upwards of $40 million to defeat the measure. Those dollars have bought billboards, home mailings, radio, and TV spots. This advertising blitzkrieg prompted the Yes campaign to lodge a formal complaint with the U.S. Justice Department last Friday regarding the use of an FDA logo on campaign literature. The FBI has indicated that it would be looking into the complaint and determining whether a criminal offense was committed. With so much information, and perhaps misinformation, flying around on both sides of the proposition, I decided to sit down with author and journalist Michael Pollan, who has written extensively about food over the past 3 decades. His most recent article in the New York Times Magazine, entitled Vote for the Dinner Party, discusses the battle over Prop 37. I asked Pollan why the issue is so murky.
Well, because there's $41 million of deceptive advertising being thrown at it right now. So people are very confused about it. I get lots of questions that suggest that people have seen the ads. Many of them around this question. Well, isn't it sloppy and full of special weird exemptions that make no sense? Like, why is the meat in dog food covered, but meat for humans is not covered? That's a very interesting way to put that question. In fact, meat of no kind is covered, but there's very little meat in dog food. There's lots of soy and corn. So if that's genetically engineered, it has to be included. So that's just an example. The what is included, what's not included is really based on the rules that have been developed in the EU, European Union, where they've had labeling for many, many years, and it works without a lot of trouble, and it hasn't increased food prices, and it's just kind of a normal part of everyday life. But it's being depicted here as this weird, arbitrary, and special interest-influenced scheme.
Is the debate about a health threat, or is it about corporate control?
Well, it's up to you. I mean, people are looking at it in both ways. And indeed, I think one of the problems with the campaign in favor has been they haven't really settled on a single message. I think the more powerful message is not health. Questions have been raised about the healthfulness of GM, but that gets you lost in the scientific weeds really quickly. And I don't think the goal here should be to scare people. And it also suggests that that's the burden of proof, that if you can prove hazard, something should be labeled. But that's not how it's supposed to work in America. If you can prove hazard, you just take it off the shelves. You don't label it. At least you hope that's what they do. So I think that that's a real red herring to get lost in the issue over health. I think that the big issue simply is the right to know, that a majority of Californians want this information about their food. And who is Monsanto or DuPont to say they can't have it? And, you know, I think the transparency issue, the right to know issue is really the ground on which this battle should have been fought.
And, I mean, the battle's only being fought now, but why didn't it happen 10 years ago when GMOs first came, you know, onto the scene?
Or in 1992 when the regulations, so-called, were being written. And that's because Monsanto fought it very, very hard. And they lobbied the FDA, who has responsibility over labeling of food, to declare that genetically modified food was substantially equivalent, that's the technical term, to conventional food and therefore didn't need to be labeled. This was not a scientific finding, though. This was a kind of a political assertion. It was developed by a former Monsanto lawyer who then went back to work for Monsanto. And in fact, the FDA has approved other perfectly safe technologies such as irradiation, which they have insisted on labeling. So it was sheer political power. And they have exerted that in the halls of Congress in the years since, in state legislatures in the years since. And they've really done a great job of stifling this move for labeling, even though 80 to 90% nationally a people survey will tell you they want it. And it just was able to bubble up because of our crazy initiative process, you know, that with 1 million people, you can get something on the ballot. And they succeeded in doing it. And that's why These politics erupted here in California.
They're here in California, but what do they say about a larger national debate about GMOs, about food and agribusiness in general?
Well, you know, it all depends on whether it passes or not. I think if it passes, it'll be a great demonstration of the power of the food movement. And if it fails, it'll be a demonstration of the weakness of the food movement, which, you know, truth be told, is not that well organized and certainly not that well funded. I think they've got, 4 or 5 million up against 41 million. And that, those are small contributions and from small organic producers. And so, you know, it really is a David and Goliath battle. But I do think it's a national issue. I don't think it's just about California. I think if it were to pass here, it would become the national norm fairly quickly. The food industry doesn't want to make different packages or different food for California. So as happened with Proposition 2, a ballot initiative a couple years ago that outlawed battery cages for laying hens and sow crates for pigs, for sows, that very quickly has become a national standard. And you see the industry moving toward that. And I think the same thing would happen here should it pass. I mean, basically, California is 13% of the market. People don't want to make special food for California.
So there's a lot of stake here.
There is a lot at stake for everybody. And I think it's very important that people in other states understand that this is their issue, too, and that they will win if this succeeds. And there is a national campaign for labeling called the Just Label It campaign. And their power in Washington, their you know, what they bring to the table will be strengthened immeasurably if this thing passes.
So you had an article in the New York Times back in October in the magazine, Vote for the Dinner Party, where you talk about whether or not there is a food movement in America. This is a question. And, you know, I think in the Bay Area, of course, people would say there is a food movement because there's so much happening kind of locally. But you talk about voting with your fork as soft politics. And what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, there is a food movement in the sense that there's a social movement and an economic movement around food. I mean, you have this burgeoning new economy that you see when you go to the farmer's market or join a CSA or even look what's in the Safeway now. Lots of organic food, lots of local food. So something's happening without question. And there's unprecedented interest in food and where it comes from and how it's made. And a whole rebirth of artisanship around food. So there's something happening, but people have created this on their own without a lot of help from government, by the way. I mean, this has really been consumers and producers reconnecting and creating these new economic forms. It's like a form of civil society. But that's all come through this voting with your fork is the phrase that people use. In other words, people making consumption decisions with an eye toward their values, not just getting a good deal. And it's been very powerful. But there are limits to how far I think that can take a movement. Finally, you need also to vote with your votes. You need to exercise power in a way that frightens legislatures or rewards legislatures and makes the government realize they can't simply do Monsanto's bidding or Tyson's bidding or any of those companies without taking account of the fact that eaters have opinions about this and may vote based on their opinions about this. So it's a moment of transition into a more hard politics way of operating for the food movement. But it isn't clear that the food movement's ready for primetime and that this is a test. Whether this was the right place to choose to make your stand is a real question. But that's the battle we found. This is what a lot of people cared about. And you know, I think whatever happens, I think that the fact that Monsanto and its allies had to cough up $41 million in the same way that the soda industry has had to cough up between $200 and $300 million to fight back soda taxes is a measure of public concern about these issues, and that the industry they can hold back the tide of citizen action, you know, as long as their money holds out. But that long term is probably not a winning strategy.
I mean, as far as, you know, really organizing, you know, for some kind of political change in Washington, is it a matter of money that the food movement doesn't have the resources to go to bat?
Well, that's kind of something we're learning this election. It may just be a matter of money. Let's see who wins. You know, we've unleashed the floodgates. We've opened the floodgates to political money just over the last year. The advertising, there's no standard of accuracy in the advertising. And I don't know what's happened there. I mean, there's been some kind of either flouting of the rules or change of the rules. But it used to be, I remember the fight over repealing AB 32. You knew it was the coal industry and the electric industry that was paying for those ads, and it said so very clearly. Now it's in minuscule type that Monsanto and DuPont, for some reason, care about this deceptive food labeling scheme, which is never described as what it is, which is to label genetically modified food. They dare not utter those words because they'll lose if they do. So I think we're about to learn is politics simply about money, or are there other ways to win these battles? And, you know, I hope that it hasn't come down to that. But it's a difficult environment because it's very hard to match corporate coffers when corporations also have freedom to, say anything they want.
Now, there appears to be, according to the evidence, that GMOs don't offer any health benefits, at least to the individual person. But, you know, is there something to be said for a technology that has kind of helped turn our national food problems from one of scarcity to one of abundance? Is it possible to feed 9 billion people without GMOs?
Well, first of all, GMOs are not responsible for creating the abundance we see in the food system. One of the greatest misconceptions about genetically modified food is that it has increased yields. And that is not a proven case by any means. In the case of soy, now yields are approximately the same. They were actually down initially with GM soy. And with the case of corn, yields are up slightly under very specific situations where you have a big corn borer infestation. So they have not unlocked the secret to yield. All the important gains in yield have been made through conventional breeding. Now, the question of can you feed the 9 billion without GM, well, jury's out on that. Again, they haven't solved the yield problem. And if you read the small print, when Monsanto says they're going to double the yield of agricultural crops, what they actually say is we will do that using conventional breeding, and then we will add our super-duper GM traits in order to lock up and own those yield gains. I think that that's these are arguments that really don't hold up. The harder questions is can a truly sustainable agriculture without using synthetic fertilizers or pesticides feed 9 billion people? That's a real debate we need to have. We don't know the answer to that. It's important to point out, though, that we're now growing something like 5,000 or 6,000 calories per person in this world, and we still have about 1 billion people who are hungry. You only need 2,000 a day. So yield is not the only measure of the success of a food system. Success of a food system is measured by getting nutrients to people and real food. And this system, dominated by a handful of global corporations, patented seeds, high capital agriculture, is failing in that test. The idea that they would do any better with 9 billion is hard to credit.
As far as what the numbers actually look like for what GMs have done, is the greater impetus to keep GMs in the market an issue of money through patents, or is it an issue of making it easier for farmers?
I think the two great advantages of GM are this. One, it makes it possible to own the genetics of our food supply in a way it was never possible before. Monsanto can prove who owns that it owns a seed at any stage in the life of that plant, and that gives unprecedented amount of control. Huge advantage, but advantage Monsanto, not advantage farmer or advantage consumer. The second advantage does go to the farmer. The farmer finds that with these crops, especially the herbicide-resistant crops, but also the BT crops, it allows the farmer to farm more land. Because basically, as you get bigger, it's very hard to keep an eye on your crops. It's very hard to know where you're having an outbreak of European corn borer, because let's say one field is in this county and another field is two counties over, and you could have a big infestation and miss it and be wiped out. If you're planting GM, the problem is sort of taken care of because the plant is going to defend itself. Ditto with weeds. You just can spray all the herbicide you want. You don't have to do it as many times. You don't have to be as careful. I mean, I hate to put it this way, but it's a recipe for lazier, easier farming. It offers convenience to farmers, and that is important to farmers in an age where they have to get big to survive. So essentially what GM has done is allowed our monocultures to get bigger. Now, is that a good thing from a social point of view? Well, I would argue that it's not. It's led to the depopulation of the farm belt. The fact that you go to these towns and cities in Iowa, and there's nobody left. You know, three high schools have to merge to create enough people to field a baseball team. So it's leading to a depopulation of the farm belt. And, you know, I think fewer eyes on the land leads to all sorts of environmental problems. And but as to the consumer, you mentioned that it doesn't offer any health benefits. It doesn't offer any benefits of any kind to the consumer yet. Maybe someday it will. They've been promising it for 18 years. But there's certainly no health benefit. There is no benefit in terms of taste, no benefit in terms of price, no benefit in terms of nutritional value. And I think that's finally the Achilles heel of the industry. If they had a good story to tell consumers, they would be thrilled to label their products. It's just in the absence of that story, the fact that they've spent 18 years focusing on selling to farmers and not talking to consumers, that they find themselves vulnerable to this kind of thing. You know, if these products are so wonderful and they are so eager to tell us how they can feed the world and increase the yield of crops and all the wonders that GM offers, why not brag about it? Why hide behind this opacity in the food chain?
When Obama took office in 2008, you wrote an open letter to him about how food as an issue of national security was going to demand his attention in the next 4 years. But food and food security are things that we haven't really seen entered into the debate this election season. Will it take something like Prop 37 passing in California to get conversations about food going on in the White House?
Well, you know, he has not put a lot of energy into this issue. However, his wife put an enormous amount of energy into his issue, and I think that was kind of a division of labor they worked out. I think Obama's take on the food movement and food issues is they're not really ripe yet to push hard, and that he's up against enormous hurdles to making any kind of change on agricultural policies. He made a little feint at agricultural subsidies in his first budget and back way off. And they have done a few good things. I mean, let's not overlook some reforms to the school lunch program, some reforms to food safety at the FDA, there was one other area of improvement. I'm sorry, I'm overlooking. But and a lot of support at the USDA. I mean, some support at the USDA for local food systems. The Kathleen Merrigan, the undersecretary or deputy secretary, has really worked hard on pulling together all the different programs and focusing it on building up farm to school, farm to other institution, farmers markets, all this kind of thing. And those are, you know, very important. She's made it a lot easier to vote with your fork. But Obama basically, you know, what he says to people who push him on these issues is, show me the movement. Make me do it. You know, that's the old FDR line. He used to say that to people. Go out and make me do it. Get organized. And the movement's trying to do that. And in a second term, should there be one, you know, I think the movement might be in a position to get more. I think actually Michelle Obama is building a constituency for change around food. And I think that's one of the effects, and it may even be the purpose of the kind of conversation she's been having around food. I think there's no question that Obama understands the links between the way we grow food and eat and the healthcare crisis on the one side and the environmental crisis on the other. And I think he understands that without addressing food, you're not going to solve either of those two problems. The challenge is, how do you do it? Well, the first thing you need to do is raise consciousness. You know, people in Berkeley know a lot more about this than people in a lot of other places. And what Michelle Obama has been doing is launching this as a national conversation, that food is the key to health, and that changing our diet is going to be the key to solving the obesity problem and the diabetes problem. So, you know, some progress is being made, and success on this vote, I think, would accelerate that progress. I think people in Washington would really take note, and they would see, wow, there are votes in this issue. And that would be a signal to people in Congress. That would be a signal to people in the USDA. And to the industry. I think we'd have a huge counteroffensive, actually, that, to make this campaign look like tiny. But, you know, we have to be ready for a big fight. This is not an easy one. There's a lot of money at stake, and the industry is not going to take this line down.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Megan.
That was journalist and author Michael Pollan. No matter what the outcome after the votes are tallied, the struggle over GMOs in the food supply is just beginning in California and the country as a whole. For Downstream, I'm Megan Multenny.